Okay, I'm gonna thank you all for coming. It's just really beautiful, and coming for a second week in a row means that last week was a success, which louder. Okay, which I'm very I was extremely happy with the nature of the conversation last week, and I want to ask, you know, and be proud again. Thank you for, you know, we understand there are real people in the room, either themselves or their parents, for whom these issues are very, very immediate. Now, at the same time, that we have to allow halakhic conversation to be open and honest, to let the sources say what they say, and then we can decide which sources, right, which interpretations we adopt, but first we have to interpret them honestly. So I'm hoping that we can continue the same level of conversation. I'm going to say up front that probably it'll be a little bit harder this week, because probably I won't be able to completely avoid expressions of opinion this week, so you can call me on it if I say something that you think is not in the sources. But the conversation should, again, please be fully respectful both of the people in the room and of the issue. So with that, I want to start by teaching the two sources that many of you did in Chavruta. They are not the Tzitzit Eliezer. The type of the title of the shiur is can surgery affect halachic sex? The position of the Tzitzit Eliezer. But I think that part of the problem with the conversation is that it takes place as if the Tzitzit Eliezer were the only position ever articulated. And so, right, so it's worth knowing that the Tzitzit Eliezer was not the first person to think about this issue and understand what the implications of the other positions might be before we get to the Tzitzit Eliezer. So the first position I gave you, which is kind of fun, first of all, it has an error on it, that it should be the 18th century, not 19th century Rabbi Shaul Berlin, so my son assures me. In a work called the Besamim Rosh, the Besamim Rosh is a very odd work. It seems to be a forgery or pseudepigraphy. It's a claim by Rabbi Shaul Berlin in the 18th century that he found a manuscript belonging to Rabbeinu Asher, the medieval figure. The contemporary consensus is that there was no such manuscript and he made it up, even though his father testifies that he saw the manuscript, and his father is a well-respected rabbi. And then the question is, so why did he make it up? Did he make it up because it was a way to get his really serious ideas into the tradition? Or did he make it up because it was a way to make fun of the tradition by showing what people would buy? So we'll read it and you can decide for yourself which one you think this one is. Okay, so the Besamim Rosh writes the following. That my honored and respected friend Rabbi Samuel, you asked me about a man who is, and we're being very graphic today, right? His penis and testicles were completely excised, right? Somebody just had their entire genitalia removed, whatever reason, and he married a woman, she being unaware of his condition, whether the condition are valid, or whether we say, even in this case, famously or infamously, the Gemara says that we don't retroactively annul the wedding. So in many cases, even though the husband seems inadequate, because we're not sure that women didn't want to be married even to this little bit of a husband. So maybe it goes this far. Now, in a footnote that I excised, the author is fully aware that this question had been asked in medieval Europe. But that's not really the question it interested him. So he keeps on upping the ante. What if this is the question of what happens if the woman didn't know about the man's condition? What happens if the woman did know the man's condition? Do we allow a marriage in which consummation is impossible? Do we consider that a marriage halakhically? Right, that's an interesting question. Halakhically, there are all sorts of precedents about that. There's a dispute between Abaye and Rava in the Gemara about what happens if a couple marries and the marriage is legitimate, but it would be forbidden for them ever to have sex. So that's an example of kedushin shlo nimsur libia, kedushin that can never be licitly consummated. There's a dispute between Abaye and Rava, but whether that constitutes a marriage at all. And then he gets to the issue that matters to us. And he says, what happens if they were already married? And then this happens. Does the woman need a get? And his answer, if you look at the last line, he says is aval shehadome, what seems right is lahatir b'lo get, to allow this woman to be free without a get. And if this happened after the marriage, lomar deguf chadash asilikan uchiishadami, and we'll say that there's a new body here. And what is this new body? This new body is Ucheisha Dami. This new body is a woman. And right, we don't recognize Kedushin among women, separate topic, different controversial series of Shurim. Mm-hmm. And therefore the woman is no longer married and free without a get. Then he says, yeah, maybe, I don't know. Right, that's how the Shuvah ends. Maybe, I don't know. Yes and no were weak in his eyes. Okay. We talked about this on Shabbat, right, that the analogy is to the wife of Eliyahu HaNavi. That is the fun Talmudic question to think about, right? What happens if you are married to somebody who is no longer marriageable? So the Besamim Rosh says that in such a case, he believes that the woman does not need a get. Now, what does this imply? Let's think about what he thinks, right? He says there's a thing called a man, and a thing called a man is somebody who has male genitalia. And then there's a thing called a woman, and a woman is a being without male genitalia. And that's it. There is no positive definition of woman at all, physically. Right? There are men, and there are not men. So this is a way in which you can, right? This is a way in which you can offer a definition of halachic sex. Halachic sex is defined exclusively by male genitalia. Now we have to be very careful, right? This is why I tend to take the position that the Besamim Rosh is satire. And nobody in halachic literature would ever have taken a position like this seriously. And it slipped in because this is right, because the Besamim Rosh, as we've said, is Rabbi Saul Berlin finding a way to sneak in all the things that rather amused him and that he thought people would buy if he presented them convincingly enough. And then he writes a very, very long commentary on them, which makes it even more interesting. All right, you can make your own decision, right? This is a whole controversy. The case I wrote about this year is he talks about, he says, a friend asked me, there's always friends who are cutouts in the questions. A friend asked me, what should he do with a student who asked him why in the Talmud are there so many rabbis named Ishmael and not one named Esav? Which is a really interesting question. And his reaction is, you must throw this student out immediately before he corrupts the entire school. And he's very vociferous about this, that this student, right? Then he spends a lot of time analyzing the question. But the first conclusion is you must, so to me, it seems clear, but my family doesn't agree with me, that this is a question he asked in yeshiva. I got a very bad reaction to. And now he's finding a way to get his back. Right, with this presentation of how you're supposed to react, in which, you know, it looks ridiculous, and then he shows you how it's really good. It is a really good question. Why are there no rabbis named Esav? There are lots of rabbis named Yishmael. You can try and give answers. Yishmael does tshuva, but there are also midrashim which Esav does tshuva. Okay. You get what the Besamim Rosh does. You can decide whether you want to take it seriously or not. For the purposes of marriage, we define man as having male genitalia, and women as not having male genitalia. Now, we can ask the question, do you think that even the Besamim Rosh would have said that this man, who has been fully castrated, is no longer obligated in mitzvot aseh shazman grama, no longer counts to a minyan? Right? Would he have said that? So if you think not, if you think that, no, he only said it for the purposes of marriage, so now we start to begin to talk about the question of whether there is a one-to-one correspondence between biological features of sex and halachic definitions of sex. Because it sounds, right, because if you said no, that means you're willing to allow a being who is male halachically for the purpose of marriage, sorry, not male, female halachically for the purpose of marriage, but male for other purposes. That's already a complicated thing if you're willing to allow that. We could ask the question more directly, right? You know, would he allow this new being to marry a man? Right? How seriously does he intend it? I think he doesn't intend it seriously at all. But thinking about your answer, right, you can start thinking about how you want to think about that question. The second thing I gave you, which was not the Sicily other, is Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv. Eliashiv was, for some time in the late 20th, early 21st century, pretty much the undisputed leader in the posik of right-wing Haredi yeshiva, Haredi non-Hasidic Judaism in Israel. He has a very interesting history because at one point he was one of the great figures of the religious Zionist movement, and it's one of the one of the great tragedies of the history of Orthodoxy in Israel is the story that led to Rav Eliashiv moving from being one of the great religious Zionist figures and a member of the Rabbinic High Court as such, to being the person who led the delegitimization of the chief rabbinate and the basically the mockery of the High Court. Any case, that's a separate conversation. Rav Eliashiv writes the following. Regarding the question of one born without male or female genitalia. Okay, so we know the Psalm in Rosh, we know what this person is. This person is a girl. Because they have neither male nor female genitalia. But Rav Eliashiv doesn't take that position. He says, and the doctors decided to use plastic surgery to make them a girl. Right? Meaning we use plastic surgery to create something that looks like female genitalia. Nobody's going to pretend that we're going to use it to create fertile. Right? We're not going to create a womb. We're not going to create ovaries. We're not going to create anything like that. Right? We're going to create something that that in the course of sex somebody could be under the illusion was a vagina, even though it's not connected to anything. Okay. So the question is, what should the halacha be here? Right? Are we worried about doing this because we are now creating somebody who will function socially as a woman, but if they are halachically a man and not a woman, there's even a possibility they're halachically a man, not a woman. So then if they get married, they're going to be engaging in male homosexuality. So there are all sorts of things that can go wrong if we allow somebody to be socially categorized as a woman when halachically they are actually a man. So Eliashiv says, well, we might think that this is an example of an androgynous in Chazal, and somebody with both male, they categorize somebody with both male and female genitalia, but he says, no, that's wrong. That is somebody with both male and female genitalia. This person has neither. So we could invent a whole new category. People without sex. Right? Not non-binary in the sense that they grow across them, but just non-sexed, asexual in the pure sense. Hold off one sec. Right? We could invent that category. Rav Eliashiv refuses to do so. And by the end of the Tshuva, he says, he says, obviously this is not an androgynous, because androgynous has both male and female genitalia. And so if they have no genitalia at all, what we have to do is follow secondary sexual characteristics. Other ways that we normally use to tell whether somebody is male or female. And he says, now in our case, he says, however, but the person is born without female genitalia, without a womb or ovaries, and also no male genitalia. There is an oddity that they do have somewhere in their abdomen. They do have something that seems like male testes. Okay, and now they have plastic surgery, and the plastic surgery is creating something like female genitalia. And so he says the following. He says, as for the vagina that the doctors arranged for them via plastic surgery, it seems obvious that a vagina created artificially is not subject to the category mishkeve isha, meaning having sex like a woman, which the Gemara says that an androgyne is still liable for homosexuality even using the feminine orifice. But this, he says, is just something created by plastic surgery. We don't care where it is. It happens to be in your body. Where, if you were a woman, there would be a vagina, but it might as well be somewhere else. It's just an artificial creation. And therefore, he says, right, he says, obvious that a vagina created artificially is not subject to this category. And regardless, he says, the established law in Eben Ezer is that if a male has relationships with another male, even if it does not involve, the established law in Eben Ezer is that if two people, a man and woman, who are halakhically forbidden to marry each other in a serious way, they're arayot, have sex without penetration, that is still a biblical violation. And he thinks, which is a separate conversation, that this is also true of two men having homosexual relations. And so he says, at the end of the day, the plastic surgery is irrelevant. The absence of male genitalia at most creates a doubt. Possibly the existence of testes resolved the doubt. So this baby is either male or possibly male. And therefore, you can't create, right? You can't use plastic surgery to turn it into a woman, because that will have all sorts of halachic consequences that we don't want. Okay, so here you have a much richer vocabulary, because we understand, right? Looking for genitalia is a default. It's not the only way we have. We have a strong position that there's no such thing as an unsexed human being. Right, that's right. That's an interesting claim. Could not have been. We have the rejection of the notion that you can have artificial genitalia having any relevance at all. All right, so there's a much richer vocabulary to talk about what constitutes halachic sex, whether or not you agree with the outcome. Okay, so now with that, let's now turn to something theoretical. This, I warn you up front, is going to be very complicated, and this is where I'm most likely to say things that are not in agreement with what you already thought. So I'm warning you up front. Challenge me if I don't. If I'm not clear. Apparently, I'm going to say things that I think disagree with whatever you've heard from whichever site. Right. So challenge me and make sure you understand what I'm saying, and let's make sure that what I'm saying is coherent.
Where is that Anasha's getting his statement
from? I have no idea. I have no idea. He provides no sources for most of the claims. We'll see, as neither does anybody else, because there may not be any sources. Okay, so here's the first thing I want to convey is the notion that a category, by definition, is an abstraction. And abstractions don't exist physically. That may seem obvious. Let me try and say it a different way. There is often presented as a debate between two positions, each of which I think are, I'll be controversial, nonsense. One position is that biological sex doesn't exist, and the other is that it does. Right? Both positions are wrong. Mm-hmm. There are clearly biological features, and those biological features clearly cluster in a certain way, not 100%, but people who have male genitalia are likely to have Adam's apples and prostates, and they're more likely to grow beards, and they're likely to have lower voices, and they're much, much more likely to be 7 feet tall, although very, very unlikely. Right? So there's all sorts of interesting ways in which biological features cluster. Now, so in that sense, you know, sex is a biological fact, in the way that height is a biological fact. And we could say that, like, we can define everybody by their height. And it's true, everyone has a height. It's a real thing. But it's not clear that it's valuable to divide the world into people 5'6" and shorter and 5'6" and taller, 5'6" and taller. Even though that's a real category that reflects biology, reflects the fact. It gets much more problematic if we decide to divide people into short and tall, because that will depend on society and on purpose. And even if we decide that it's valuable to divide people into short and tall, it will turn out that what we mean by short and tall is contextual. So for example, I like giving basketball analogies. It turns out that being tall but having short arms is really not helpful in basketball. And so many people's, you know, lives have been ruined because they grow up with everyone expecting them to be great basketball players who are capable of blocking shots. But the truth is that their hands don't reach higher than mine because they have very, very short hands. That is a deep, right? People whose heads are high but whose hands are short are not tall basketball players. They're short basketball players. Okay, so when we talk about sex, we have to be clear, right? That we're talking, what we're claiming is that we are sex as a biological category is an abstraction, claiming that it's useful to classify people in accordance with a certain set of biological characteristics, which we can, right? And it's only useful if there are things that we learn from that categorization, right? That I can know, I can predict things about you, right? By calling you a male, so some of it is just polite, right? That way people can walk around with clothes on and we can still identify what your genitalia are likely to be, right? That may have a certain purpose. But also, right, I can expect certain things about your voice. I can expect certain things about your strength. Possibly I can expect certain things about your personality, and we get more dangerous. Right? Maybe I'll have certain social expectations of you. And those expectations will play out in halakha. But it's only useful, right, to say that biological sex is a category if that teaches me something about people. That's what I call correlations. Or if it enables me to expect things of them. Right? That's why I care about identifying people by sex. Right? There's no purpose in just saying, right, that's a person, right? That's a person with male genitalia if it teaches me nothing whatsoever about that. That's just a tautology. I can just point to them and say, that is a person with the following organs. Okay, that's right. Now, sex in that sense can be biological, but I want to point out it can also be metaphysical. And that's a much bigger challenge. There are Kabbalists who believe that there are masculine or male and female souls. Right? The one place where I first learned this, which still has power for me, is that the Kaf HaChaim and the Sfardi Acharon explains that Michal Bat Sha'ul wore tefillin, and the rabbis didn't object. We could talk about halachically, but he says, Michal Bat Sha'ul wore tefillin, and the rabbis didn't object, because they and she both knew that she had a male soul. Now be very careful. They didn't say that Michal Bat Sha'ul was obligated in tefillin, because maybe obligation is a product of biological sex. But they said that, but normally they said, even right, the way the Kaf HaChaim sets it up, normally in his world, wearing tefillin is a male obligation. That's right, halakha, which then creates a gendered performance that men wear tefillin and women don't. And women shouldn't wear tefillin, perhaps because that is seen as being male. But Michal Bat Sha'ul, because she had a male soul, so that was an appropriate performance for her. Even the right of performance, gender performance for her, even though her obligation is a function of sex. That's a way in which you can set it up. And what it tells you is, right, for our purposes, that correlation is never perfect. Right, because you can argue, right, that, you know, that 99.99% of the time, God creates biological sex and matches it with metaphysical sex. All right, and so it's a reasonable thing to know. If you know that somebody has male genitalia, you will also know that they have a masculine soul. That's a really, really good rule of thumb. It lets you run society in many, many ways, but you should know that it's not absolutely perfect. You can have exceptions. If you accept the notion of souls having gender, you might not accept that at all. Right, that's a whole, but I just want to set up that idea, right, that, you know, that there's a difference between, obviously, between biological and metaphysical sex. And it's just that we generally assume a perfect correlation, and then there are Kabbalists who assume an imperfect correlation. Right? Kabbalists who believe in reincarnation have a specifically hard time believing that the souls are always matched up. Okay, so sex is biological or metaphysical. Gender is about behavior or perception. Let's say, right, how you behave, right? That's your gender. It may be that certain behaviors correspond very well with sex. Like it may be that males are much more likely to dunk than females, and that may be because of reasons of biology or because of reasons of culture. But it corresponds very well. If you see somebody dunk, you probably have a 99% chance that that is a male. But there's nothing intrinsically male about it. It just happens to be that's the way males behave in basketball, if they're tall enough. And their hands are big enough, right? All sorts of reasons that dunking is easier. The second thing, which is really important, though, right? So gender is behavior. Now, we can decide as a society that we want to mandate that people behave in the way that correlates with their sex, right? The vast majority of male basketball players can dunk, and the vast majority of female basketball players cannot dunk, but there are occasional female basketball players who could dunk, we're going to ban it. Because we think that creates gender confusion. Right? We could decide that if we wanted to. We can mandate behaviors which are not necessary. There also are gender behaviors which are arbitrary and not linked at all. For example, it may be that clothing, that some clothing is essentially, right, much more linked to sexual characteristics, like brassieres. Right, most men don't wear brassieres because brassieres are uncomfortable, I'm told, and it's, right, and therefore you would not wear one unless you absolutely had to. Right, so that's an example of clothing that is right? It's a gendered behavior to wear a bra, but it's not a but it's not an arbitrary behavior. There's a reason that women tend to wear them and men tend not to. On the other hand, pants, maybe not. It just happens to be cultural that in some cultures males wear pants, and in some cultures females wear pants, and in some cultures both wear pants. And it might be that we have a value in society in saying that in this society we want to reinforce the distinction between the sexes by mandating that this arbitrary distinction be imposed on both men and women. Or we might not do. We might not. Okay, but the second thing, which is even more important about gender, is that gender is about perception. All right, gender is about how other people react to you. Okay, right. So if other people react to you as male or female, right? That's part of a gender thing. It's not who you are. Right? People could get it entirely wrong. Right? Gemara, to talk about. Let's get right where Reish Lakish sees Rabbi Yochanan swimming, and assumes that he's female because he's beardless, and therefore goes out to try and have a sexual tryst with him. Right, this is before he becomes frum. Right, this is the moment that he becomes frum. Right, but he reacts. Right, so Rabbi Yochanan being female in Reish Lakish's eyes is a question of gender. Now it's connected to a particular biological fact, which is Rabbi Yochanan had no beard. But Rabbi Yochanan was male. But Reish Lakish reacted to him as female in that moment. And that can happen in a much wider array of things, and it can happen because of the way you dress, or it can happen despite the way you dress. And part of it depends on what you consider as the way in which people react to males and the way in which people react to females. And it's part of why sexual orientation is such a critical part of gender performance. Because you might say that one of the ways in which you are gendered female is that men react to you as a potential sexual partner and women do not. And when you have homosexuality, so that whole notion of gender becomes confused in a society because you no longer have that expectation. Right? That's a second way in which society is being, right, in which gender performance is can be very, very confused. Okay, now I want to get to, I think, what is really probably the most important distinction in this regard, which is that...
The metaphysical going to sex and not gender, because by Michal Bashitwell, you were saying that
it's what she is. It's not how she acts. We might allow her a gender performance because of her sex, but we're allowing it not because of her sex, because she has a masculine soul.
As perceived by the rabbis and herself.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't exist until unless someone perceives it. But the claim is we are perceiving an actuality. Yeah, no, they were. I mean, the Kaf HaChaim was. That's all. It's a different claim. Okay, yes, Nathan.
I'm just trying to clarify what you mean when you say that gender is like intrinsically connected to perception. Like, you wouldn't say that Rabbi Yochanan seeing Rabbi Yochanan as feminine, like, made Rabbi
Yochanan
female in that instance.
Again, I think that gender has two components, behavioral and perceptual. Right, the way in which people react to you is a function. Right, is a function of gender. It doesn't mean gender is intrinsically perceptual, but the way in which people react to you is gender, not sex. They might react to you because of your sex, but there are people, right? But they won't always. Sometimes they'll react to you despite your sex.
So, could I react incorrectly? Like, what would it
be? Yeah.
Yeah, like this would be a case of Reish Lakish like misgendering Rabbi
Yochanan.
That's helpful language at all.
With that. So, what's the difference between gender and sex then? Or is gender, are you just saying that's just a verb?
Like, what if you spend your life, right? Everyone treats you as male. But you're actually female.
So is my gender then male? Is that
yeah,
what you're saying?
Exactly right. Your gender is then male. Deborah Sampson in the army is male. From a gender perspective, she's biologically okay. Female, but her gender is male because everyone reacts to her as male.
Is there like a threshold at which point somebody becomes?
So everything has a cutoff point, but it's easy there because everyone reacts to her in every way.
Right.
And all elements of gender performance, everyone reacts to her as male. That's easy. Okay. Now I want to talk about what I think is the biggest thing, and then we'll actually get, well, we're almost at the Cecilia answer. You'll see how it all, I think it's all fair to tie in. Right, there's sex and there's gender, and then there's identity, what you think you are. And what you think you are can relate to both sex and gender, and those can be disconnected. You can say to yourself, right, this is, right, I think I ought to have the other genitalia, or I think I do have the other genitalia. I think we get that the first one, I do have the other genitalia, is a hallucination. And I ought to have the other genitalia is, on the surface, a disconnect between mind and body that is unhealthy. We can figure out how we react to that, right? We can bring your mind and body into alignment, perhaps through surgery, but we can't pretend that, right, that if you think that your body is not what it ought to be, right? So ideally, unless your body is radically unhealthy, right, people are better off if they think their body is what it is, right? The body ought to be what it is. That's a big issue generally. That's one kind of thing. There's a second kind of thing, which is I have no issue with my body, but I do think that I ought to behave in the way in which society assigns as a gender to the other body. So I am perfectly comfortable having male genitalia, but I want to do lots of things that society tends to code as female and to react badly to me if I do those things, which we can put in ways we addressed last week halakhically: makeup, playing with Barbies, maybe, although that seems to be culturally dependent, basketball, whatever it may be. You can have a person, right, whose identity is entirely different than the way people treat them. Right? Could be, right, somebody goes through life and everybody reacts to them as female, but their identity is male. In one of two ways, or three ways, right? It could be they know themselves biologically, could be they know themselves metaphysically. It could be that their sense of what behavior is appropriate for them is different. So their identity generally, I would say, is, I'm trying to line it out the same way. Identity is a function of sex. Somebody says, right, I identify as somebody with a male body even though I have a female body. And perception is a function of gender. Right? I see myself as the kind of person who should behave this way. Okay, right? So that's a whole set of characteristics. And we talk about what halacha is. So we have to figure out, right, what does halacha mandate in terms of, right, you know, what are the things that are intrinsically connected to biology? There are lots of gender perform, right? Halacha can't mandate having a body, but halacha can mandate performing in certain ways. Which are the things that halacha mandates be connected to biology? And where are the things that halacha might just demand consistency? You always have to behave in a particular gendered fashion, which is hard if some things are connected to biology, then it's hard to be consistent. If some things are connected to biology, even if some things aren't intrinsically. And to what extent, how does halacha relate to people who have identities that conflict with the way in which halacha assigns identities? Okay, so now in terms of what constitutes biological identities, right? So I think we already showed through the through Rav Eliashiv and Rav Simon Rosh that there are lots of ways in which you could, lots of features which you could use to assign biological identity, which usually correlate, but not always. Right? One is just sexual organs. But we have cases of castrates or people born without them, so that can't be the only assignation of gender unless we have genderless people or unless all people without male genitalia are female. And even there, we can distinguish between appearance and function, which is part of what the progression in the Besamim Rosh is. What happens if you have somebody who has male genitalia but they're non-functional? Right? Are they male for the purposes of marriage? Okay, then you have reproductive organs, which are totally separate from sexual organs. So imagine if we, through plastic surgery, we construct somebody with male genitalia, but they retain a womb. Are they male or female? Are they androgynes? Right, we can certainly do that. We can do anything we want, right? Whatever we do with plastic surgery now, we can do independently of anyone's reproductive organs. Right, so there's no reason we can't create somebody with female reproductive organs and male, right, and male genitalia, or vice versa. Okay, then we have secondary sexual, other correlated physical characteristics, things that go along with either sexual or reproductive organs, but not directly connected to them, like Adam's apples, right, or beards. Then we have genes, right? We haven't mentioned genes at all so far. Right, we could just decide that. We define people who have XY chromosomes are male, even if for some reason they were exposed to, right, to hormones in the womb that had made them develop female genitalia, or vice versa. And anyone who is XX is female. And I don't know what people are XY, perhaps are androgynes. regardless of any other physical characteristics, their genitalia, the reproductive tracts, whether those are functioning or non-functioning, right? So that's a fourth criteria, and then we could just use chemistry, right? So we should be aware that so if you're a halakhist, right, you have to deal with all the edge cases, and you have to try and figure out what should your definition be. Okay, right. So when we talk about how we should construct the halakhot of sex and gender, right, we should be aware that we're talking about all these features. And as I mentioned last week, right, we can go through Parashat Bereshit and talk about how we have terms that might or might not align with some of these, like Zachar and Nekeva. Right? Zachar and Nekeva might be terms that relate to genitalia, might be terms that relate to reproduction, as opposed to Ish V'Isha, which seem to relate to certain kinds of relationship performance, which may or may not be correlated with physical characteristics. Ava'im, right, print, right, which is a totally separate thing, right, brother and sister. Or there are all sorts of ways in which we can use terms that way. Okay, so now I want to talk about the Sitzelieser. Now, here's why it's important to talk about the Sitzelieser after all this, because the halakhic conversation generally begins and ends with the Sitzelieser. And I'll be frank, right, when the conversation is intended to end with the Sitzelieser, it's usually a claim that the Sitzelieser says that all that matters is external genitalia, and that artificially constructed genitalia are the same as natural genitalia, and therefore the Sitzelieser says that sex reassignment surgery works to change halakhic sex. So we're going to be investigating now whether the Sitzelieser really says that, and then we'll talk briefly about whether we ought to want the Sitzelieser to say that. Okay, so here's what the Sitzelieser says. We're on page 4 now. This is 10.25.26.6. There's many, many subsections in the Sitzelieser. And according to Rabbi Sisvinensky, this was published in 1967. He says the following. There is need, the Hebrew is on page 5 if you want to follow it there. There is need for a full-scale investigation of halakha regarding where there occurs qualitative organic change in a human body. As, for example, from male to female or vice versa. Okay, that's his category, right? Qualitative organic change in a human body. Right, the Hebrew is a change that is mahuti organi, right? So I didn't do much with the organic there. Right, and mahut, right? If it helps you all, if you like Latin, it's quiddity, right? Whatness. Okay, then he says, as for example, if it transformed from male to female or vice versa, I have heard, and this has also been publicized in various journals, that nowadays surgeries such as these are even performed in special cases. They're obviously rare. Such a qualitative change truly generates many questions that touch on establishing the identity and personality of such a human being. So you could certainly read the Sitzelieser as saying, I have heard reports of surgery that transforms people from male to female, and I understand, right? And that really raises big halakhic questions. Except that he also talks about qualitative organic change. And plastic surgery is not qualitative organic change. It's the opposite of qualitative organic change. It's just, right, it's just cosmetic change. Now, he's writing in 1967. And he tells you that he's writing in response to public reports in various periodicals which he doesn't name. And he quotes other things that he thinks are relevant to this discussion. He quotes a work called Zichron Brit Rishonim, a much earlier work, which has a kind of, for lack of a better thing, right? You know, what used to be called a freak show, right? Like in Sherwood Anderson's Weinberg, Ohio, right? That, you know, have traveling museums of oddities. So these are people who write lists of odd things they have seen, and among the odd things they have seen are tumtums and androgynouses. And, right, so there's a long thing, and among them, right, in that book, he talks about incidents of transforming from female to male naturally, right, and he finds a manuscript written by an unnamed holy sage of Jerusalem who says he's seen such cases, and then he goes on to explain it, because he says, it's not such a hard thing to believe, because actually, there is no difference between male and female genitalia, they're just one is just the other one inside out. So why should it be hard to change from one to the other? Right. He also says at the end that he has right. So they said, and the person who talks about this case, right, explains, right, women internally has a foreskin and things that are like testicles. And the question is, right, maybe a woman who's insides become outside is now, right, is she obligated to circumcise her foreskin? right? That's the question that's the question that comes up. Right, and he also deals with the question of divorce, and he includes it in such a case. It seems that that the woman does not need a divorce. That's what the Bessam Rosh was playing off, right? That you have a tshuva which says that if a man becomes a woman, his wife does not need a divorce. Okay, so I submit, and you know, you can say this is wrong. I'm telling you what the evidence is. Nobody could call plastic surgery the way we do it a qualitative organic change. The whole point of saying qualitative organic is to exclude a merely cosmetic change. Yes?
Yeah. But it's not done just cosmetically, it's also done hormonally.
The surgery you might have other things, right? You might want to, right now we're just talking about the surgery. Right? The surgery is cosmetic surgery.
Right, but I don't think the surgery would or could be done without the hormones being changed.
Why not? Why not? Surgery. Not to create a vagina or to excise the penis. That's surgery. You want to also have secondary sexual characteristics be applied, right? You want to talk about whether breasts are large or small. You want to talk about, right, whether you grow a beard, things like that. That is the thing. But the surgery is surgery. One should not confuse the surgery with the other things you might also want to do. Yeah, we'll talk about that, right? But if the position of the Sitz Eliezer is that all that matters is external genitalia, then everything you're saying should be irrelevant, right? Because the external genitalia is only affected by the surgery, and that's all, right? That's all there is. So you want to build a more developed position, which is surgery plus, sure. But that's not right. So far, we haven't mentioned that at all. He just talks about surgery, and then he talks about cases that are miraculous, which he thinks are not so miraculous because he has a physiological explanation which we no longer accept. Yes? Yeah.
What are the surgeries he's talking about?
Exactly. So I think that at the time he was seeing reports, and there were such attempts in the 30s. I don't know if there were such attempts in the 60s, but I don't have the periodicals he's reading, in which people did in fact attempt to introduce reproductive organs when they were doing sex reassignment surgery. And there's still a question whether he could pull it off. It might be possible. So I think that's what he was talking about. I think that he, or at least that he believed, that the question he was addressing was a case in which you actually engaged in a qualitative organic change because you took a being that was reproductively male and made it female, or a being that was reproductively female and made it male.
So you're assuming that the qualitative thing that makes you male is the reproductive organ.
I am assuming that at this point. Now you might want to argue, right, as Janet said also, maybe we can find an intermediate category, right? Maybe we would argue that there are ways of engaging in qualitative organic change that are non-surgical, but also nonetheless count as qualitative and organic. I'm open to that, right? That's why right now I'm just trying to explore the Sitz Eliezer.
I don't understand why in your mind the surgical change in the external genitalia does not qualify as a qualitative change.
I think the word organic is a giveaway that you're not talking about plastic surgery.
Just be distinguishing between gender and sex distinctions that you made before, that it's not about social behavior, not about the things that you wear, not about the way that you behave, but something in your body that we can agree would be an organic structure, in a plain sense of the term. And what he means is that there's something that's fundamentally changing about the body of the person, which I think could also be the cosmetic surgery. We're not talking about
I could be cheap in distinguishing in your body and on your body, but I think that's probably too facile. I think that would be too facile. I'll try it a different way. He gives many other examples throughout the Tshuva. All those examples are genuine, right, functional shifts, and to compare plastic surgery, going out of your way to say it's a change organi mahuti, and compare it to cases of absolute transformations, and we'll see. We'll read a second truth in a moment, which I think will make that clearer. I think it would be an extraordinary reading to claim that he's equating plastic surgery with complete change of a body without anyway, using a term that seems to set a high standard and really means something the same, that seems to me to be a poor reading. But I can't prove it, right? It's a poor reading, I think. Yes, Avi.
So what are some examples of qualitative organic change?
Miraculous. For now, the only right we know is he has medieval reports of oddities, where people just woke up one morning.
Anything perhaps more modern or verified?
He has nothing, okay. Right? All he says is right. All he says at this point, right? We're going to read one more tshuva, right? Which comes many, many years later. Well, he has evidence from reports in periodicals which we don't have access to. Right, we could go back to 1967, and we have to find out whether he's reading JAMA or reading the work or reading the National Enquirer. Right, we don't know. He says various periodicals. We don't know. You could say that I trust Rabbi Wildenberg. He wouldn't be reading the National Enquirer. Therefore, this must be something real. So his reports must be accurate, and then you'll find Tag's reading somewhat stronger. I don't, because I just see that word, right, that it's just going to such effort to say that that it's not just that you're constructing, right, it has to be something beyond just the construction of genitalia, I think. But I think we should withhold judgment until we read the second Shuva, and then we'll get to the third and see. Right? Yes?
When we're talking about qualitative organic change, mm-hmm. I mean, what he says first is male to female. Which this wouldn't apply to, but for the vice versa, there are conditions where a person's anatomy appears to be female until puberty, when
I understand we have
is that possibly something he was referring to?
Could be, but that would be reconstructions in our own terms, right? Same way as if we were to say, well, really what happened at Kriyas Yamsuf was that there was an earthquake and there was a conjunction of the planets in such a way that the gravitational pull caused the water, right? Okay. But that's not what he's relating to a miracle. Right? Or I should say, to be fair, he's relating to what he saw as a natural phenomenon, which we would regard as a claim of a miracle. Right? Because of his perspective, he has reports of this happening. Sometimes women wake up men, sometimes men wake up women. Right? He doesn't limit it to puberty cases or anything like that. He just he has reports, right? It happens all the time. Sometimes men wake up women, sometimes women wake up men. It says so. Now, I might be cynical and say it says so right next to, right next to the reports of mythical beasts. It might very well be that and I saw, right, this man, right, the man woke up, he was a woman, immediately went out to the field and captured a unicorn. Right, maybe, I don't know. I'm cynical about it, but Tag is less cynical, perhaps. Yes.
The question I have, and partly it also deals with, I don't know what might be punctuation you added with parentheses, but there's the with the framing of, I'm just looking at the English now, I have to look at the Hebrew, but saying that we don't find any difference between the characteristics of the male genitalia and the female genitalia,
yeah,
except that he has his organs external and she internal, and then having a parentheses, I don't know if you added those or...
No, I didn't add any parentheses. What do you mean?
Because a woman internally has a foreskin and egg slash chest.
Yeah.
So they're not pure.
Right, that's...
So that means that makes, if it's in parentheses, to me that implies it's secondary to the idea of the external versus internal distinction.
Maybe. I mean, it's in his original. This is not him. This is not really Waldenberg talking. He's just quoting the medieval True. Text he's doing. So I wouldn't.
Although he is using it as a source.
Yeah, I wouldn't read so much into it. Okay. Yes, then.
Mark says such a qualitative change. Isn't that referring to the surgeries in previous sessions?
The question is, what did he think those surgeries were doing? If he thinks those surgeries are purely cosmetic, which is what Tag wants to argue, then that's the argument he's making. If you think that, like, in context, that can't be what he means by the surgery, he must believe the surgeries involve implanting reproductive organs. Okay, so I want to read the next shuvah, because you'll see what the argument is, and you'll see if you buy it or not. The next shuvah is 1997, so we're 30 years later. All right, we're 30 years after the first shuvah, and here's what it says: a clarification of the halacha regarding a man who has turned into a woman. What is her legal status? To his honor, my dear friend, etc., Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu Sfarik, Chief Rabbi of Israel. Regarding the question you were asked from the diaspora about a giver, right, that thought I should leave the Hebrew in because of last week, right, who turned all the way into a woman, right? What his legal status is? I told you in our earlier meeting that I remembered a question like this being asked of Yosef Pilagi in one of his books, and then he quotes the same book, the same things he quoted in 1967 about the travelogues, about people seeing things, and then he adds something new, right? After, right, so right, we're 30 years later. He quotes everything he quoted, but he makes no reference to surgery. Right, he's asked the question from Israel: What happens if a gever turns into a woman? He answers the question without any reference to surgery. He just says, oh, I remember this thing I wrote 30 years ago and all these sources, quotes all the sources, and adds one new source. I will cite as well the words of Korban Netanel on Rush at the end of Yom HaMavet, chapter 8, note 6, who says, I found in the book's Tales of Tovia, section Small World, Microcosm, chapter 5, they wrote in the name of several wise doctors that they testified regarding several androgynous, that an androgynous sired children from his wife and afterward married a man and birthed children like an absolute woman. Okay, so he has a new report. Right? A new report of androgynes who are fertile both ways. This is also brought in Rav Elgazi to Hilchot Bechorah 658 in more polished form. The analytic doctors wrote that there was an incident with androgynes who were married to men and birthed sons and daughters, and afterward married men, and they also sired sons and daughters, as in the book's Tales of Tovia, section Microcosm, chapter 5. Okay, so reports here, really here is not androgynes who are simultaneously fertile as men and women. What he reports is, what he has a report of androgynes who are sequentially, consecutively fertile as men and women. And now he says, since I have reports of people who are sequentially male and female, therefore in your case, Rabbi Leo, where you asked the question about the halakha of a man who turned into a woman, or right, what is their status? The answer is, we have to give them the status of androgynes, because maybe they're just the kind of person who turns back and forth from men to women. Now, lots of people ask, isn't this a contradiction? In the first tshuva, he said that we accept the outcome of the surgery, and here he says they're androgynes. No, he's not talking about our surgery at all. In the first tshuva, he assumes that the definition of androgyne is somebody who has both male and female genitalia simultaneously, and therefore the miraculous person is not an androgyne, so they are whatever they are. But in the second tshuva, he's discovered a report of people, right, which is as serious scientifically as all the other reports he has of changes from men to women. And he says, okay, well, now that I know that there's a possibility, now you'll tell me, why did he not know about this possibility before? So we'll find out in the third tshuva momentarily that he is aware of a halachic position, that that's what an androgyne is. But before he discovered reports of this, he thought that position was absurd. But in this tshuva, he has discovered a report that there actually are people who physically report that there are beings who are male one day, male 1 month and female the next month. And so therefore he says, okay, so if you have a case of somebody who flips from male to female, you can't assign them to either gender because they might be this kind of being who magically shifts from one to the other. I think once you understand that, and you notice that in his 1997 tshuva, 30 years later, he makes no mention of surgery at all. And he assumes that the question Rabbi Leo asks is not about surgery, but about this miraculous type of occurrence. To the point that he decides, right, he answers Rabbi Leo, right? I think the answer is that the result is an androgyne because it could be one of these cases. That's not what surgery is. You can't, right? You don't flip back the next month. Yeah.
Do you think that it's reasonable to read this tshuva, the Tzitz Eliezer, who is at this time the accepted authority on medical halakha, that he receives this question from the chief rabbi of Israel,
mm-hmm.
that in the 90s, when sex reassignment surgery was already not uncommon, and you think that the best way to read this tshuva is that the Tzitz Eliezer fundamentally misunderstood the question that was being asked to him by the chief rabbi, and the chief rabbi was asking him about miraculous cases of people who switched back and forth from male to female, and that was the answer that he was answering the chief rabbi without any further investigation about the question he was being asked as the accepted mumcha on Dinei Refuah in the
So I appreciate the rhetoric of the accepted mumcha on refuah. And I would say, I would have had a much harder time saying this had Rabbi Michael Broyd not commented in an article I wrote on Brain Death some years ago that it's evident that one of the famous tshuvot on brain death is a medical impossibility. And right, when you, and Rabbi Broyd is utterly right that one of the tshuvot deals with a case that just never happens and couldn't have happened, and that suggested to me that maybe the Sicilyezer's medical knowledge wasn't as deep, perhaps, as we assumed.
But the argument that you're making here is essentially that either the chief rabbi of Israel asked him a question about a miraculous case that he heard about in the diaspora, which seems like an unlikely kind of correspondence to be had between the chief rabbi of Israel and someone who was at least accepted as a serious decisor on medical issues, or that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was in fact asking him a serious question about real cases that were happening with fair frequency, perhaps exclusively in the diaspora, but perhaps also in the state of Israel. And the Tzitz Eliezer simply misunderstood the question that was being posed to him and answered the question without any further attempt to clarify the question.
Yeah, you're right.
And the thought he was being asked the question about miraculous cases that came from the diaspora that for some reason were addressed to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who was the chief rabbi.
I don't have a better answer. I understand, you know, I applaud the sarcasm. Well done. but it would be unserious the other way also never to mention that it's a result of surgery. Right? You have to make an argument that surgery is the same.
The argument is that these are common occurrences that are happening that, of course, speak to deeply relevant halakhic issues in the Orthodox world, yom-yom.
And so the
and
best.
So they're being addressed to a serious.
And how do you explain the ending as an androgyne?
I'm sorry.
How do you explain the ending as an androgyne?
Okay, so in the intervening 30 years, he had a change of.
But it's irrelevant to the surgery.
What do you mean it's irrelevant?
The case he's talking about androgyne is spontaneous shift back and forth, right? It doesn't tell you anything.
And under the assumption that the surgery could be reversed.
Also, now we have a new assumption: the surgery can be reversed, and that the fact that it can be reversed consciously makes you the same as.
Surgery to construct, you have a surgery to deconstruct.
But you also have to assume that all human beings are androgynes.
Perhaps only if they can actually change.
No, they can. Everyone can change. Everyone can have the surgery.
No, but the fact that the person is capable at this point of siring children with a woman, or is capable at this.
No, they're not. They're not. That's the point.
That has never happened in an actual case.
Surgery never gives you that.
Happened, you know, he has said that there are, in Tales of Tovia, and that he wrote in the name of several wise doctors. So his only source for that is this Tales of Tovia, not any actual.
If you had a surgery that actually produced the capacity for men to be, for formerly biological men to now be reproductive women, if you could do that, that would be a wholly different thing.
But that has not happened.
But there's no such surgery. Surgery is purely cosmetic. So how can he, what's the relevance? How can you decide you're an androgyne because of the fact that some people genuinely shift spontaneously, both ways? What does that have to do with surgery? If you think that the fact that you can switch shift it back makes it, then every human being is an androgyne because we can all have the surgery. I think that's a good argument. Yes, David.
It's hard to say because you read. Somehow that turned them all the way around.
I don't know how he did it. I don't know what he thought. You know, there were when sex reassignment surgery was pioneered in the 1930s, right? There were attempts to transplant a uterus, right? And they failed. Person died. That was a failure. But there are still questions of whether it has to be. Right? It might be that surgical techniques really are much improved. Just nobody's tried it yet. I assume people will try it in the next decade. And when they try it, it might very well be a very different question halachically. Okay, the last tshuva that Tzitz Eliezer is a special case, but it requires requires careful attention, right? So he says, right, this is a question asked by a Dr. A. Schlussheim, who I think Gershon found at some point who he was. I don't remember. I am not acquainted with Dr. Schlussheim. And Dr. Schlussheim asked, right, I have an infant born over a year ago. At birth, it was not possible to tell with certainty the sex of the child. The external appearance was female, and the Sicilianized pronouns just shift back and forth from male to female randomly. So I'm using they to address to it, right, to avoid making any implications from the male and female pronouns in a Sicilianized. You can all read them. Right, so they were named Yorona. At 6 months, the child is hospitalized, and they're trying to figure out what sex is the child. They discover that the external sexual organs seem female, but inside one of the labia, there's a lump that looks like a testicle. They biopsy the testicle, and they discover that in fact it is a testicle, and that the child appears to be biologically male. Right, so you have external genitalia appearing female, but internal test chemical tests show male, but there are no internal sex organs at all. The only male organ you have is this one testicle that is found inside something that looks like a labia. So the question, right? So the question they're being asked is, are you allowed to remove that one testicle, and thereby make the child female? So the Sicilianizer says, I think that the child is female before you remove the testicle, and therefore there's no issue removing the testicle. Because right now he has the line which becomes very important, right? And it's also very important to distinguish between, right? Let's read the Sicilianizer's response and not Dr. Schlussheim's question. In my opinion, the child around whom this question revolves, even if they were left as they are, is legally categorized as female. I mean to say, they would not be subject even to the category androgynous, because the signs of being androgynous are explained in the Talmud Yerushalmi as having actual male and female genitalia, as opposed to Rebbe Eliashiv, right, who thinks that androgynous is somebody whom you can't tell. Rebbe Eliashiv says, Rebbe Sicilianizer at this point, he hasn't found the report yet, right, this is 1970, thinks that, right, an androgynous has to have both genitalia. He says the opinion of some other poskim is that the androgynous shifts sexual indications by month, sometimes male and sometimes female, but this seems to be a rejected position, right? As I told you, he knows about this position already in 1970. He just thinks it's rejected, and what changes in 1997 is that he finds testimony for its existence. The child we are discussing, as described in your letter, in practice, their external genitalia appear female, and they have no external signs of a male organ, just that the analyses and tests that they underwent show that they have male cells in their body. Therefore, my opinion is as above, that even if we leave them as is, they will be categorized as female, because the external organs that are visible are what determines in halacha. Okay, then he says, by the way, I heard from a doctor that all the hormones are the same, all that matters is the percentage, and therefore hormones can't be the distinguishing feature, it has to be genitalia. Okay, let's just take it at absolute face value the way it is, that tells you nothing about artificial genitalia. Right, he's trying to determine the sex of a child. Right, of a child. And he says the shape of genitalia matter. Okay, doesn't tell you that if you change it tomorrow, it makes a difference. I think if you understand the other shuvah the way I do, there's no reason to read this shuvah saying anything significant at all about most cases. Okay, so my underlying thing, right, is that the Sicilianizer doesn't ever deal with the reality of what we call sex reassignment surgery. Now the question I want to talk about is, what ought we to think? So I gave you the Besamim Rosh because I thought that the Besamim Rosh would horrify you all. And the Besamim Rosh would horrify you all not just because the Besamim Rosh defines women as human beings who are not male, as opposed to there being anything about being a woman, but because he defines sex by physical criteria without any regard to identity. The question is, do we want a definition of biological sex that cares nothing whatsoever about what you think you are? Now, that is a problem for people, right? You know, the system which assigns it biologically, but it's equally a problem for a system that assigns it deliberately in a couple of ways. So the polemical point here, is that there is one country in the world in which sex reassignment surgery is highly encouraged and government supported, and that country is Iran. The reason is that Iran doesn't like homosexuals. And so getting homosexuals to perform sex reassignment surgery is seen as an excellent thing, and it works. It gets rid of the homosexuality. So I think we really have to think about, and I credit my friend Shira Batya Lewin-Solomons for making this point very forcefully in her lectures on this, is do, right, in whatever universe we end up halachically, is it really going to be any kind of gain to adopt a definition of sex that is wholly independent of identity and is purely dependent on external? It won't be modern because it will ignore all the other data we have. It ignores genetics, it ignores chemistry. It won't be sophisticated because it's a single characteristic. And it won't be moral because, right, if your issue is allowing people to conform their identity, because it doesn't. If it happens to you forcefully against your will, right, that presumably the person in the Psalm and Rosh, right, who was castrated, does not wish to identify as a woman, but tough noogies. Right? So I think that's, now here's the point I want to leave on, and that's where we'll start picking up next week. Another really, really important issue. Here I'm you know, maybe going above my pay grade, and so you can all, you know, the therapist in the room can certainly yell at me. And I haven't done enough research to do this right, but this is just where I am based on conversations. You have to be really, really careful in distinguishing whether the dysmorphia, whatever you want to call it, that people are reporting is about sex or about gender. If it's about sex, right, that people think their bodies are wrong, that's right, and that's absolute. So it's true that there is not going to be any fix for that other than surgery, right? Unless we can find some form of therapy that reconciles people, right? That's true. But what I am at this point told is that almost in almost every case, the discomfort with the body is a function of the gender expectations that are generated by having such a body. And it's that people don't want to have the body that is responded to in this way, or that generates, right, and the discomfort with the body is inextricably mixed up with the expectations of the body, as opposed to a sense of self. If that's true, then I think we should be very careful about setting up a halachic policy which tells you that the only way you can have what you want is if you undergo radical body alteration, which certainly is, this point is irreversible in the sense of fertility, even if it's not irreversible cosmetically, and is never fully reversible. So I think that regardless of what one's end position is, right, it's probably not a good position in the interim to say that we're going to set up a model which says you can have what you want, but in order to have what you want, you have to right now undergo radical surgery. And until you do that, we won't give you anything, because we're just going to keep, right, we're going to keep a complete asymmetry, whatever it is, between sex and gender. So until you have the surgery, right, you have to behave exactly like your biological gender. And right, no matter how many other things you've done since then, right, no matter what hormone treatments you've gone on, no matter how you appear socially, right, none of that is relevant. All that matters, right, because we're posturing like this reading of the Sicily Ezer, all that matters is external genitalia. I think that's probably a very, very unwise, here, get my, a very, very unwise policy. So we want to think about where halacha should go. So I think, A, it doesn't, right, the claim that we rely purely on external genitalia doesn't correspond to what anyone wants morally. It's a purely pragmatic effort to get to what, right, to what some people think would be the right end. But nobody thinks that genitalia are what should determine identity. It has, I think, pernicious social consequences, as I just articulated. And thirdly, it's wrong. It's not the Sicily Ezer. Right, so for all those reasons, I don't think that's the right way to go. We'll talk about next week about the Dor Tapuchot, which is the first halachic work that attempts to explore what sorts of gender halachic requirements are connected to what sort, right, to biology, and what sort are not, and in what way. For example, just to tip something, the Dor Tapuchot argues plausibly that halakhic restrictions imposed on men because we are afraid that they will rape women do not apply to castrates. And therefore, people who have had certain kinds of, right, people, right, men who have had bottom surgery, right, there's much less of an issue of there being an ichud with women. Right, that's just in a way which you might realize, oh my goodness, right, it doesn't require saying that, right, saying that you're a biological woman. It doesn't require saying that you're now, you know, longer chayav mitzvot aseh as mangrama. But we can solve that particular issue for that particular person if we want to. So it might, right, so we'll start exploring next week about what are the issues we can solve which way, and right, and what are the issues we ought to solve which way in that regard. And then we can talk in the fourth week about, you know, granted that there's a lot of things we could do, it doesn't mean that we ought to do any or all of them. So we'll talk about, right, so in the fourth week, hopefully we'll get to move towards towards a sense of ought as opposed to what is possible. Thank you again for listening. If people want to come up and ask questions privately afterwards, I think that's better than holding everybody hostage this time because it's already late. Thank you very, again, I think the community can be very proud of itself. Thank you.